Hi, I'm Ruth. I'm one of the pastors here at Cedar Ridge. And today is the second week in our mini-series called Psalms, a Soundtrack for Our Lives. And in this series, we're looking at three different psalms and seeing how what they have to say is relevant to us today in our current situation. The psalms are ancient songs. They were probably collected together around the 3rd century BCE, but some of them seem to date back much more than that, possibly hundreds of years before that. We don't know exactly how old some of them are. But not only are they very ancient, they were, of course, written by people who lived in a culture that would seem very foreign to us. Their life experience was unquestionably very different to ours. And yet, people are people. There are aspects of being human that transcend time and geography and culture. And so while we can't totally enter into the psalmist's experience and their worldview, we can learn from it and we can use it to reflect on our own experiences. These songwriters, thousands of years ago, they witnessed and experienced violence and oppression. Sometimes they perpetrated it too. They suffered illness and loss. They experienced financial hardships and material needs. And they felt the full range of emotions that we too feel in such situations. They express anger and anxiety, frustration, guilt, shame, exhaustion, despair, and so on. A wide range of emotions, some of which will resonate more with us than others do right now, depending on our situation and our own life experience. But before we launch in today's psalm, I think it's important to remember that the psalms are songs. They are not theological treatises. They are expressions of the heart, not necessarily models of what should be in our hearts. Matthew mentioned last week that there are expressions of hatred and violence in the psalms that can seem pretty shocking, to us as we read them there in scripture. I don't think that these passages are presented as the right way to think and feel necessarily. I think in the context of scripture as a whole, we see that there are aspects to them that are not what God would have for us. But they can be challenging and they can be instructive nevertheless, as we see some of those feelings that are expressed actually reflected in our own hearts, as we feel them resonating. There's something about seeing things made explicit in black and white that can make us stop and reconsider what's actually in our own hearts. And I think we'll see some of that in the psalm today. So let's start by reading it, and Hannah is going to read it for us.
Today's psalm is Psalm 139. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them? Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. If only you, God, would slay the wicked, away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting.
Thank you, Hannah. This is a really beautiful psalm, I think, and parts of it are very popular. The first 18 verses, as well as the last couple of verses, the search me God verses, they get quoted a lot. There are modern songs written about them. There are lovely meditations online based on them. You can get them printed, on dishcloths or notebook covers, you name it. The Christian printing business turns out this stuff. But you almost never see or hear the verses about slaying the wicked or wanting to destroy the bloodthirsty quoted or printed anywhere. It's very rare to see those verses. But I think we do a disservice to the psalm by skipping over the bits that we don't like or we feel uncomfortable with. The songwriter put these different elements together, and so we should look at them together. I think that will give us a more complete picture of what is being communicated here. So we'll look at the whole of this song, but I don't want us to dissect it too much because, again, it is a song, it's poetry, and I think if we get too much into what the individual words mean, we'll lose the sense of beauty. In addition, the main theme of the song is being known rather than knowing. It's not about us breaking things down and struggling to understand. It's rather about yielding to the fact that we are known, we're fully known. So we'll try today to do a bit more yielding and a little less dissecting. So in these first verses that Hannah just read, the songwriter expressed an overwhelming sense of wonder at God knowing him or her. The psalmist is not just known in some kind of a generic way, simply because God knows everything. The writer says that God has actively sought out and searched him or her. Culturally, it probably was a male, so I'm just going to call the writer he, although we don't know that for certain. And the writer says that God knows him better than he knows himself. He says, "Before a word is on my tongue, Lord, you know it completely." I don't know how that makes you feel. I'm going to ask Darren actually in a few minutes how it makes him feel. But for me, the idea that God knows me completely, knows me better than I know myself, brings for me a sense of relief. Because it means that with God, I don't need to pretend to be someone I'm not. I don't need to perform. I don't need to explain or justify myself or try to convince God to think well of me. I can let go of all that. I can let down my guard and just be myself. I can be honest and vulnerable with God. And I think there's something very freeing about that. I think many of us, maybe all of us at some time, long to be known, to be really known. But sometimes we're also afraid that if people knew what we're really like, they'd reject us. And so we end up trying to project a certain image so that we will be accepted and loved and thought well of. And that leads to feelings of not being really known. And that can feed a sense of loneliness and isolation. But this psalm says that God does know us thoroughly in a really deep and intimate way. And yet God doesn't reject us, doesn't push us away. In fact, far from it. The psalmist continues, "You hem me in before and behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain." The psalmist uses an interesting word here. He says, God hems him in before and behind. The word translated as hem doesn't mean held in an embrace or protected on all sides. It means literally besieged. Again, this is a song, it's poetic. I don't think we should put too much weight on an individual word, but there is a sense that there is no escaping God, even if you want to. In fact, it goes on, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence?" And the writer continues with this beautiful imagery that gives the answer, nowhere. There's no hiding from God. God is always there. "If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast." I wonder how differently we might live if we were constantly aware of God's presence with us. I remember reading a story when I was in college, a long time ago, several decades ago, about Jesus physically turning up at someone's doorstep. Obviously, this was a fictional account. Jesus turned up and the person was really thrilled and invited Jesus in. And at first this guy was challenged by Jesus' presence and clung to every word. But then he wanted to watch something on TV and he was not really sure Jesus would approve of it. And it kind of felt uncomfortable. And then he was gossiping about someone on the phone and asked Jesus if he'd mind going in another room. And it was a silly story. It was a little preachy, a bit heavy-handed, to be honest. But it ended, I think, with someone coming over and the guy asking Jesus if he'd mind stepping into the closet for a minute because he didn't want his friend to see him. And then he decided, actually, it was really better just to leave Jesus in the closet. Again, silly story. But it struck a chord with me that stayed with me, made me wonder, do I really want to be aware of God's presence with me all the time? Sometimes I think maybe I don't. On the other hand, there is something incredibly reassuring about being besieged by a good God, a God of love, a God who pursues us, who doesn't let us go, a God who chooses to be with us, even in the darkness. And then we get to perhaps the most popular part of this psalm that speaks of being fearfully and wonderfully made. Fearfully here is perhaps better translated, awesomely. The way we are made should generate in us a sense of awe. Because humans are amazing. We are amazing in our diversity. At the cellular level, for example, we see incredible variation between disc-like red blood cells and stretched out muscle cells, globular fat cells and scaly skin cells and wiry, web-like nerve cells, and so on. We are incredibly complex and diverse. And of course, we see that diversity at the macro level too, with all our different appearances, our different personalities, our different ethnicities and genders and sexualities. Humans are so richly diverse, and we are all fearfully and wonderfully made. God knit together each and every one of us. We are all made in God's image. God has searched and knows each and every one of us. God is with each and every one of us. None of us can flee from God's presence. Which implies that even though we are each unique individuals, we are also bound together in a very fundamental way. I love the imagery of that opening video that we saw. Whether or not you believe in the Big Bang, there is a very real sense in which we are all one. We all come from the same source, from the life and light that burst forth in the beginning. We are all children of the God who is love. We are bound together in our fearful and wonderful humanity. And this leads the psalmist to sing out in praise. He writes, "How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you." Note, there's a shift in perspective at the end there. The psalmist is not saying now that God chooses to be with him, though he said that previously. Now he's saying that he chooses to be with God. I am still with you. And I think there's a lovely counterbalance in this song between God besieging us on one hand, and on the other, at the end of our fleeing and our hiding and our measuring, as we see here, when we awake, when we come to our senses maybe, we declare that we are with God. But then we come to this less lovely section. "If only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies." Strong, passionate words. And I think there are a number of things to note here. First of all, since God knows the psalmist, God already knows his anger, his hatred even, of his enemies. There is honesty here. This is what's in his heart. Second, his rage does not seem to be directed at personal enemies. There's no indication here that these are people who have wronged the psalmist himself in some way. Rather, this is directed at the bloodthirsty, those with evil intent. It doesn't seem to be about individuals so much as against groups, or we might even extend that to systems that are violent and unjust. And third, the psalmist asks God to deal with them, to slay the wicked, to do away with the bloodthirsty. The psalmist himself is not intent on exacting vengeance, or he doesn't express that here. Rather, he is looking to God to act, to intervene, to right the wrongs and establish justice. But he's clearly angry, passionately angry. He says, "I hate those who hate you, Lord." He identifies his anger with God's anger towards violence and oppression. There's a great quote by Martin Niemöller, a German pastor who opposed the Nazis. He said, "It took me a long time to understand that God is not the enemy of my enemies. God is not even the enemy of God's enemies." And I think this is important because, like the psalmist, we can be quick to assume that our personal enemies, individuals who we struggle with, are God's enemies. And therefore, it's okay to hate them with a self-righteous kind of hatred. But of course, we know as followers of Jesus that we are called to love even our enemies. And Jesus didn't just teach that, he lived it. He forgave even his executioners. So at the individual level, clearly hatred is not okay. But in terms of systems and categories, the bloodthirsty, the oppressors, the unjust, that should make us angry. Because as the psalmist is here claiming, God is angry about these things. God hates oppression and injustice. There are literally hundreds of verses to that effect throughout the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. God is angry at injustice, and we should be too. And in our current context, with the spotlight that has been shone on racial injustice in particular right now, this should be a challenge to white people like me who can afford not to be outraged, or who have the luxury of being angry for a while and can then move on to other things. We should be angry. God is angry. Injustice, whether that's injustice due to race or sexual identity or economic status or any other mark of division, is a violent assault on our oneness as humanity, fearfully and wonderfully made. It is a direct negation of the fact that we are all made in God's image, all known by God, all surrounded by God's presence. Injustice, violence, oppression, discrimination, those things should cause us outrage. And the psalmist brings his outrage to God. He expresses what's in his heart. He owns both his anger and his hatred. And then he yields them to God's scrutiny and to God's judgment. He sings, "Search me, God, know my heart, test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me and lead me in the way everlasting." Now, God knows him already, of course. The songwriter has sung about that at length. But here he is inviting God to search him and to guide him in his anger. He is opening up his heart and his mind to God because God knows him better than he knows himself. We assume we are on the side of the righteous, but it's so easy for us to be blind to ways in which we oppress others, or we benefit from systems that oppress others. It's so easy to miss our own prejudices and microaggressions, to overlook or excuse our apathy. Henry Melville, a 19th century English chaplain, wrote of these verses, "I call upon you to be cautious in using this prayer. It's easy to mock God by asking him to search you whilst you have made but little effort to search yourselves, and perhaps still less to act upon the result of the scrutiny." The psalmist asks not just that God would search him for any offensive way, but also that God would know his anxious thoughts. And some of us may be feeling anxious today. We may be feeling overwhelmed with the weight of our emotions in response to all that's going on. If so, Let's do as the psalmist said, let's yield that to God too. At this point, I want to invite Darren to join me and to give us his thoughts on this psalm. Hi, Darren. Great to see you. Thank you for joining our service this morning.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Darren, not everybody may know you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I'm Darren Freeman Coppedge. I've been going to Cedar Ridge for many years, I think since 2005. I met my husband at Cedar Ridge, and we got married at Cedar Ridge. And we are pretty deeply connected to the community. But we did go away when I went back to graduate school to get a psychology degree in Boston. So we were away for 5 years, and we came back almost 2 years ago now. One of the reasons we wanted to come back was to Maryland, was to be back with Cedar Ridge. It was, it's been a pivotal spiritual community for me and for my husband and now our son. And it is our sort of spiritual home.
That's great to hear. Cool. So we've been talking this morning about Psalm 139. How does that psalm resonate with you?
In 100 different ways. I should say that, you know, in my spiritual journey, that Psalms, and particularly David's Psalms, have always resonated with me a great deal. I feel like I connect with David a lot. I think if there's any person in the Bible who was most like me, it's probably David.
Why do you say that?
He is so emotional. He is so like, you know, I can't help, as a psychologist, I can't help but read the Bible and like diagnose people. And David has this like anxiety disorder, and he's like depressed all the time, and then is just completely joyous at other times. And he has these really high highs and really low lows, and he just puts it all out there. That's kind of how I've always been. He's always been my spirit Bible character.
Cool.
So this scripture resonates with me a lot. And I'm sorry if you hear screaming, that would be my child in the background. Sorry.
I hope it's your child and not your husband.
Yes. Well, it'll probably be the both of them soon. you know, I had a really difficult time integrating sort of these very different parts of my identity. I grew up in an African-American community, black family, all black church. My dad was a minister in that church, so I'm a preacher's kid. And I also am gay, and it took me a long time to admit that to myself, years, and then it took me a really long time to admit that to other people. And when I initially sort of came out to myself and then came out to my parents, I decided that I was going to fight my sexuality, that I was going to try to become straight. And for 5 years, I spent much of my emotional and spiritual energy and mental energy in that effort to change my sexuality. And it was pretty devastating for me. I became very depressed, very anxious, very lonely. And right up until I started to become passively suicidal and not wanting to live here anymore on this planet, that I began to do some real reflection about what I thought God might be thinking about me, because up until that point, I had really absorbed what the church, my church growing up, and all the churches that I attended during college and graduate school, and really tried to live up to what I think a lot of people were saying about me and how I ought to live. And at that point, I decided, you know what, I've never really asked God, what do you think about me? And so this scripture became something that I reflected on a lot, that I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And I didn't believe that. I really didn't. I mean, for a very, very, very long time, I thought there was something gross, disgusting about me because of who I loved, who I was attracted to. And so my first couple of years at Cedar Ridge, I remember after every service kind of going to the altar and kneeling and praying and God speaking to me the same message week after week after week after week. Darren, you're okay. Darren, you are okay. And reading scriptures like, Darren, you are fearfully and wonderfully made, that you, that I need you, want you to come just as you are, was transformative for me. And it took a long time to internalize that message. And when I did, things changed. And I would love to say that like all of my problems were solved. I never experienced any depression anymore. I was never anxious again. That's just not the case. I certainly still live a very full emotional life. I have not been suicidal since then,
So throughout this whole time, you were a pastor's kid and you grew up thinking that it was not okay to be who you were, but you stuck with God the whole time or were you tempted to, you know, I mean, this psalm talks about where can I flee from your spirit? Were you tempted to flee or how was that for you?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think so much of what was driving the need to change my orientation, to change who I was actually a deep fear that I was going to go to hell. So I was not tempted at that point to run away, though there have been plenty of times in my life where I've really questioned deity and whether God exists, have flirted with agnosticism and atheism, probably starting in college. Because I grew up in a Christian school and was in Christian schools up until I went to college and had always been taught creationism. And then I get to college at the University of Maryland, College Park. And I was a biochemistry major. And so I was taking lots of biology classes and molecular bio and like, what is all of this evolution stuff? And it really, for the first time in my life, it was my senior year of college. I remember really struggling with the concept of everything I've been taught may not be at all correct, and maybe there is no God. And it was terrifying at first. But I managed to just kind of like squelch those thoughts because it was terrifying. And then through the process of trying to change my orientation and then sort of becoming integrated as a Black gay man, I did at times struggle with integrating my faith and my understanding of faith. And I can say that there were some years where I could conceptualize the universe as not needing God. Mm-hmm. And I really felt like, I'm not sure what that makes me anymore. If I can really see how all of this can come to be without a God, what am I? Am I still a Christian? And after probably 2 years of really wrestling with that question, I remember one day just kind of thinking, after seeing The Life of Pi, that's really what did it for me. And I don't want to give too much away, but I think the crux of the book and the movie is this idea of like, what story do you like better? Which one works better for you? And I just decided that day that like the Jesus story, even if it's not true, I like it better. And so I said, you know, even to this day, I can still see this world being as it is without there being a God, but I've decided to believe in the Jesus story anyway.
Why does that story work better for you than it, this all being chance?
I think it works better for me because I have this undying, I'm a skeptic and I am a pessimist. And yet there is this undying part of me that is hopeful, mm-hmm. that somehow, some way, good is better than evil and that everything can be redeemed. Mm-hmm. And that is all part and parcel of the Jesus story, the Jesus narrative. And that just seems better to me than this is all chaos and chance and what will happen is whatever will happen. So I think it's that hopeful part of me that wants to see good triumph over evil and wants to see purpose and meaning in life and wants to see redemption of all things.
So like the psalmist, you're saying, when I awake, I'm still with you, right?
Yes. Yeah. I've decided to be with you.
Right.
Even if you may not be there, like maybe it's all a figment of my imagination, but I have decided I want to be with you. One thing I go back to is an experience in my journey to try to change my sexual orientation. One evening, I was just feeling like a failure in that effort and feeling so depressed and lonely and was just weeping. And I had an experience that I've never had before and have not had since, but I felt what I could only describe as a full invasion of my body, that I felt something had just wrapped itself around me. And there was a communication that was beyond words. And so it was a knowing that something communicated with me, I know every part of you and I love you.
Wow.
And it was powerful for me, and more powerful now as I think back on it, because what was not said was, and I encourage you to keep on the journey to try to change your sexual orientation. It was just as you are, I love you, I know.
Unconditionally, yeah.
I am with you, I am here with you, and that unconditional kind of love. And so when I was struggling with my faith and struggling with questions about whether God exists or not, I kept going back to that experience and feeling like, how could I deny it? Now I have some logical answers and ideas about, you know, maybe that was just
kicks in, right?
Yeah, like I could explain that experience, but none of those explanations match what I know. Sometimes you just know things, and
deep down, almost. Yeah, almost physical, yeah. Right?
Right. You know, it's like when you see something and you know you see it and everyone says, well, I didn't see that. But it's like, but I know I saw it, mm-hmm. Right? This was that. I know I experienced that. I know I felt that. And that was a foundational experience for me, so that when I wrestle with, can I really do this Christian thing? Can I really do this God thing anymore? I go back to that. Mm-hmm. And that felt like an instance of God chasing me.
Mm-hmm.
And how come my friends don't have that experience?
Right.
Did God not chase them? And so that's something I still wrestle with and struggle with, and lots of theological questions about, like, why God intervenes, when he does, to whom he does. And I don't have lots of answers for that. I just know that God's grace is big enough for all of us, whether we believe in him or not.
So there's that section that we don't like to quote so much about, you know, God do away with the murderous and the bloodthirsty. And I'm just wondering how, you know, right now, obviously a very tumultuous time. How are you as a person of color dealing with that? Does this psalm say anything to you about that? Just, you know, can you speak to that whole situation right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think anger, I can't talk about this without talking about anger,
right.
How much anger has been a part of my life, mm-hmm. and anger at, I think ultimately anger at injustice, but I think when anger becomes the only emotion that you are allowing yourself to feel, it can become toxic.
Right.
And so that anger about injustice becomes an anger and a hatred of white people. Growing up in a Black community and seeing disadvantage and seeing the way that my community is being treated, mm-hmm. Seeing, you know, like watching and reading things like Roots and reading, you know, some of the premier authors of the Harlem Renaissance, for example, it creates a lot of anger about the way I'm treated, the way I'm seen, the way I'm viewed. And that became a hatred of white people that I, and then, And then a fear of like, whoa, where did that come from? Like, why am I being this way? And so I identify with that sense of like, God, just destroy them all. Just kill them. This is awful. The anger that came when I finally did recognize my sexuality and my faith, the anger at the years of abuse, the years of mistreatment from people, the years of hating myself because I was told that there was something disgusting about me, just turned into this anger at the church, particularly at the evangelical church. And so I that anger feels very familiar. Like, this is why David and I are like twins. That I get where that comes from. And I think anger is a really righteous thing. I think anger is the most appropriate reaction to injustice. And I think anger should...
Well, God feels, right? I mean, so correct. The heart of God is...
Yeah. And I think that anger, you know, anger as an emotion, I always, you know, I do a lot of emotion-focused kind of therapy, and anger is really a protective kind of emotion, that it is what rises up when something is done wrong to me, and so I need to do something to protect myself or to protect other people. Right. And that's why I think it's the appropriate emotion for injustice, because it is what drives you to both protect yourself and to protect the innocent. Mm-hmm. And I think where it gets sticky is when anger becomes the action instead of driving the action.
Right.
That's when I think it gets really toxic, and I've certainly experienced that in my life. I should have no reason really to like the church or be favorable to the church at all, given the mistreatment that I've experienced from the white church as a black man, from the evangelical church as a gay man. And yet that is not what I lead with. Mm-hmm. When the injustices, when I see the injustices, do I get angry? Yes. And that drives my action. It drives me to work and lead in love, in empathy, out of my hurt, out of my pain.
But how do you make that transition? Because, you know, many of us maybe get to the anger and we kind of get stuck there. So how do you make that transition to making it drive you to act out of love?
I think for me, one, it was giving myself a few years to just let anger be.
Right.
To allow myself to feel it, to say this is okay to feel, and it's good and it's righteous. And when I recognized that it was becoming toxic, to really reckon with myself about, okay, am I letting this go too far? And then lots of time praying and meditating. And ultimately for me, it was pragmatic. It was, my anger isn't accomplishing anything, right, except lots of fights on Facebook where nobody learns a darn thing. Nobody's changing for the better. If I want to see change happen, I know that when I lead with anger, and that's all that there is there, that naturally creates for people a fight or flight response. Either they shut down, or they run away because they're afraid, or they get angry themselves, and now we're just fighting. And that, it was like, well, this isn't accomplishing anything. Mm-hmm. So I better learn some way, somehow, to do something other than just anger. And then years of figuring out how to do that, how to feel my hurt, because the anger was this sort of secondary to the hurt and the pain. And when I started to lead with vulnerable hurt and pain, conversations were very different. When I led with, here's the truth of the matter here, and the truth is hard to say because I know the truth is perhaps going to hurt you, then I was having very different conversations.
So what gives you hope right now?
Ooh.
So you're a hopeful person, even though you have that skeptical side.
Yes. And so I'm nervous about talking about my hope, because I think, you know, as a Black person, I've always... So much of what we're talking about today, what we're protesting today, I had just kind of assumed, well, This has been the case for a long time, right? Like police brutality is not new.
Right.
It's just now we have cameras to prove it. No one was listening before.
Right.
And so I've always just kind of like settled in my heart, like, this is just how it's always going to be. I wish it was different, but I just kind of settled for this is it. And so I'm afraid to talk about my hope because I don't want my hope to be dashed again, as it has many times in the past. But what I can say is I'm seeing things I've never seen before. The Black Lives Matter movement, for example, we've been organized and protesting since Trayvon, right? And that was, what, 2013? And what I'd never seen before is this many white people coming to join the cause, this many non-Black people of color coming to join the marches. I've never, in any of the previous incidents, had tons of white friends calling to check in. How are you doing? How is this sitting with you? Mm-hmm. On one hand, that's a little annoying, but I understand the intent behind it, and it's unprecedented.
Right.
And so something is changing and something is shifting. The number of conversations I'm seeing on Facebook, where usually I felt like I would have to intervene and say something in order to defend my community and defend mm-hmm. what's being fought for, I'm seeing white people policing themselves mm-hmm. and defending the Black community. And that's unprecedented. I've not seen that before. So that's giving me hope. I hope that turns into long-term action and change. But what gives me hope is this sense of reckoning with ourselves that I'm witnessing. And I hope that that's not acute, but that it is permanent and transformative.
Thank you so much, Darren. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks, Ruth.
The writer ends Psalm 139 by asking God to search his heart and then lead him in the way everlasting. As Darren so eloquently put it, we need this current sense of reckoning to become transformative, to lead to change, to set us firmly in the way everlasting, the way of God, a God of love who hates injustice. In just a moment, Darren and his family will lead us in communion. But before that, we are going to do a prayer practice that we've used many times before, and that's the welcoming prayer. These are unprecedented times, both because of the heightened attention to racial injustice and the many impacts of the coronavirus pandemic. These things affect all of us differently. And so we're going to spend just a few minutes listening to our emotions, owning them, and yielding them to God. I invite you to make yourselves physically comfortable with your back straight, feet on the floor. Close your eyes and take 3 deep breaths. As you breathe out, imagine any tension leaving your body and flowing down and away from you on the floor. We pray. God, we come to you because we believe you are here with us. We believe you are good and powerful, and you love us. You know us intimately. You know us better than we know ourselves. Search us, O Lord, and know our hearts. Test us and know our thoughts. We're going to take a few moments to notice any tension or pain or negative emotions that we're carrying. Feel them. Sink into them. Don't resist them. Allow yourself to focus and mentally locate the place in your body, maybe even put your hand on that place. Where do you feel these emotions and sensations? Gently sink into them. Just stay with that sensation until you really feel it. And say in your mind, welcome anger or guilt or pain or whatever it is that you're feeling. Name it, welcome it, without judging or without analyzing. Just welcome it as something that points to the reality of what's going on in you and where you are in this current moment. Now let go of this sensation, this emotion. Surrender it to God. Say, God, I give you my anger or pain or whatever it is you're feeling. I let it go. I place it into your hands. You have searched us, God, and you know us. You perceive our thoughts from afar. We cannot hide from you. Even the darkness is as light to you. We thank you, God, that you are with us and within us, and we too choose to be with you. May we submit ourselves more and more to your transforming love. Lead us in the way everlasting. Amen.